And now, I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Paul G. from Albuquerque.
Hi, everybody. My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm real happy to be here. And as an update, you know, I spoke here 2.5 years ago, and at that time, I had just been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And the interesting thing that happened there that made me very grateful to be in the program was, and for those of you who heard this, it's going to be a repeat somewhat, but the doctor was just finished having a biopsy taken to confirm the prostate cancer. And he's there in his little office saying, the results are in, and I got to tell you, it's positive. You've got prostate cancer and this number and that and all of information. And I'm sitting there just listening to him, you know, and after a few minutes, he looked at me and he says, "Have you understood anything I've told you?" I said, "Yeah, you're telling me I've got cancer." He says, "Yeah, but I've done this to hundreds of guys, and they've all reacted. They've all, you know, some have broken down, others, and you're just sitting there." And I said, "Well, I don't know what else you want me to do, you know." And he says, "Well, you know, most people show a lot more concern about this." And I said, "Well, I guess those other people don't have what I've got going for me in my life." And, you know, everybody in this room knows what I was referring to. It was a higher power. And I said, "You know, whether I live or die as a result of this has nothing to do with you or me. It has to do with a power greater than myself." And he says, "Wow." He says, "I wish the other guys had the same attitude that you have towards this, you know." And my attitude was, "You know, you're a doctor and you're reporting this stuff to me, and I'm going to listen to you and understand what you're saying because you're the doctor, the oncologist, and know all about this stuff. Now, if you want to learn how to drive ships, I'll help you out on that because I'm a retired naval officer." And he says, "Oh, it's just interesting as heck." Well, to give you an update from there, I then went about and did what I'm supposed to do. You know, this is something new. Huh? I did what I'm supposed to do. Thanks, Bill. You got any candy? Okay. So, you know, I went down to, there's a very good library. Thank you very much. I went down to the library, and there's a library down there on prostate cancer, and I did all the reading. I talked to people. I even talked to somebody from Albuquerque. I talked to somebody back here in San Diego, somebody up in Washington, somebody in Florida, and got as much information as I could. And after I'd gotten all the information that I could on this, I made a decision as to which one. There's a lot of treatments that are available to prostate cancer people. And I made the decision of which way I was going to go, which happened to be radiation. And when I was talking to some of my friends down there, they said, "Have you decided what you're going to do?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to go through this intensive radiation thing." And the guy says, "Well, do you really think that's the right thing to do?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, how do you know it's the right thing to do?" I said, "Because I made the decision." What else do you want me to do? You know, I made the decision. I'm going to go through it. And the bottom line of that is that it's in complete remission right now, and everything's great and wonderful. But you have, yeah, thank you, God. You know, and then I'll get into this God routine a little bit here, but which isn't me. But, you know, it was just a case of trusting. One of my favorite phrases in AA is trust the process. Trust this process works. And that's a big issue for me to get to that point. When I first got here, and I'll get back a little bit as to what it was like to prove to you I'm an alcoholic. Some people in this room know that I am, but you know, the one thing is that, you know, that reading in Appendix 2 where Herbert Spencer says contempt prior to investigation? Well, that was me when I started realizing, being told that I had a drinking problem. I knew one thing about my drinking problem, and that was that AA does not work. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind about that. And the reason for that was the fact that I had, they're all dead. I had three uncles who were alcoholics, and they came to AA, and they went out and drank. They came to AA, went out and drank, came to AA. I had a dad who came to AA, went out and drank. All four of those guys died still drinking. One guy went to an AA meeting in upstate New York in the mid-40s, and he died in the mid-80s still drinking. And, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of meetings he went to, et cetera, and stuff like that. So when I'm being told that I may have a drinking problem, an alcohol problem, I know one thing. You know, you go to AA to get the heat off. You know, you tell absolutely everybody, oh, don't worry about me. I'm going to AA, you know. Yeah, I know I got a drinking problem, you know, and stuff like that. And so I went to, and I don't want to get too far ahead on this one until I prove to you I'm an alcoholic. But the bottom line is that is every time I came to AA, which are numerous times, I knew, you know, you're here to get the heat off. And when the heat's off, Paul's off. And that went on for a long time. But I'll back up a minute here to make sure you know you're talking. There's an alcoholic talking to you. As I said, alcohol was a big issue, and I have nothing against organized religion, but I've got to say this. The two major issues in my life as a young boy were alcoholism and Catholicism. And I have nothing against Catholicism. My sponsor won't allow me to do that. and that's a good point. My sponsor is old Bob over there. Young Bob. But anyway, I knew those were the two big issues in our life. And those were obviously the alcoholism was something that was not talked about in our family. You know, the classic case of the tiger in the living room, the elephant in the living room, whatever it was, but we didn't talk about alcoholism. Anyway, I'm about a 13-year-old. I'm in the Bronx. Let me back up one more because it'll come into play significantly later on. I was born in upstate New York in a little French-Canadian enclave. I was raised in the French language. That's all I knew was French. At the age of four, we moved to the Bronx. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Bronx, French is not the native language of the Bronx. Yeah. But it was all I knew, you know. Yeah, that's right. It's a good point. Neither was English. But So anyway, we get down to the Bronx, and I'm a little four-year-old, and you know, the relation of higher powers to ourselves is very easy to understand sometimes. In my case, I'm 4 years old. There was a six-year-old named Peter Sanson who lived in the same apartment house that I did. And six-year-olds are higher powers to four-year-olds. And Peter was very upset that I could not speak English. And every afternoon he would chase me down, you know, and rough me up a little bit and say, speak English, je ne peux pas, I can't, I don't know English, you know, speak English, you know. How do you convince this guy in French that you can't speak English when all he knows is English? So anyway, but after a period of time that this would go on in the afternoons, if I could swallow my pride and ego. Big issues, huh? If I could swallow my pride and ego, I went up to apartment 9J, I didn't have a key, I was too young for that, rang the bell, and my brother, who's 11, would come to the door. And I'd say, Bobby, Peter Sampson's beating me up again. Bob would go down, find Peter Sampson, rough up Peter Sampson, and tell Peter Sampson, leave my kid brother alone. And you know that for the rest of that afternoon, evening, Peter Sampson didn't bother me. And it's sort of like a third step, isn't it? If I swallow my pride and ego enough to ask my higher power to help me, my alcohol doesn't bother me anymore. So I learned that lesson as a very young kid. Anyway, I'm in the Bronx, and this one day, I've thought about this for years, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but one day I'm in my apartment, I'm in our apartment, and we very lower middle class people. We live very close to the subway tracks, the elevated subway tracks. And if you've ever seen a movie with a subway going by in an apartment and things starting to move and rattle, that was my home, you know. But that's okay. Anyhow, this one day, I don't know why I said it, there were three closets in this in our apartment house, and the middle one was the linen closet. Now, don't ask me why I'm in the linen closet, but I went in the linen. And I found this pint bottle of blended whiskey. And I took that thing and looked at it and I said, this is the thing that's causing all the commotion around this house. You know, this stuff here. And I wonder what it's like. And I unscrewed the top, you know, and took a sniff. Oh, man, that stuff is vile. I said, well, maybe it's like Limburger cheese. It smells bad, but it tastes good or does something good, you know? So anyway, I took a slug of that. And, of course, it was terrible. You know, my started smoking up my ears, my hair's on fire, my tongue's melting, you name it. You know, that stuff is terrible. And I went back in the living room, and I'm sitting there, and, you know, by the time I got to the living room, that terrible reaction of my hair, my tongue, my teeth, and all that sort of stuff, that booze had arrived down here. And for me, the magic of alcohol started right away. I said, man, alive, this stuff. All of a sudden, I lost, you know, a lot. I'm no longer a little, pudgy little kid. All of a sudden, I'm much taller. Lost a lot of weight, you know, and feeling just wonderful. And you know darn well exactly what I did immediately after that, huh? I went back to the closet. And I got, and from that day on, I'm about 13 or 14, about, for me, this is just my story here, huh? But from that day on, I never had enough to drink. Each and every opportunity from 13 to 46, I drank all I could, every time I could, et cetera, et cetera. And the only thing that stopped me on that particular day is I looked at the bottle after a while and I said, I'll bet your mom has marked this thing so she'll be able to keep track of how much dad has taken out of it if he finds it, you know. And that scared me enough, so I started replenishing it with water. You know, and all of a sudden this blended whiskey started looking like cream soda. And I said, you know, I better stop right where I am right now. So that's the important part of the type of alcoholic I was. I sponsor a lot of guys, and every once in a while, one of them say, well, geez, I don't know. How do you think I became an alcoholic? And I said, I don't know how you became an alcoholic. Are you one? Well, yeah, but I'm really worried about how I became one. And I said, why? What the hell? I'm 6 feet tall. Now, let's see. Did I get to be 6 feet? Yeah, it's stupid. You know, drop it. Whether you became alcoholic because of hereditary, you know, it's from my family or something, or you became that way because you're from the Bronx or what, it doesn't make any difference. It just doesn't. The issue is, are you an alcoholic? And the guy says, well, yeah. I said, okay, now we can move. Now we can move. Don't, if you want to go back and worry about the psychological aspects of this or that and stuff, you do that, but don't ask me to do it with you. So we go back, and you know, and it became very obvious to me that I was going to be just like my uncle, just like my dad's. I'm an alcoholic. I can't stop drinking once I start. I believe 100% the doctor's opinion of I have a mental obsession that tells me it's okay to drink. Hell, in January here, I'll have 25 years. I'm sure my mind's going to tell me, well, you know, at the 25-year point, we usually celebrate. No, please don't tell me that, you know. And I have this mental obsession that tells me it'll be different this time. It's okay this time. You deserve it after all those years, et cetera, et cetera. And once I take a drink, the phenomenon of craving takes place in me, and I take another and another and another and another. And I just don't stop until for some reason, I either run out of money, run out of breath, run out of booze, run out of something. It's the only thing that's going to stop me. Or someone, and I'll tell you, I'll get to that one in a few minutes, someone who is threatened to do something to me that I don't want to be done shows up, if I'm drinking again, shows up drinking, and I'm drinking. So the bottom line is I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I'm of the variety that I have no ability whatsoever to stop drinking. Once I start, just none whatsoever. Something has to cause me to stop. Just a couple of short stories that prove that. I'm a retired naval officer, and I had a couple of tours in Vietnam, and not on ships off the coast. I mean, in Vietnam as an advisor and then in the Navy Riverine Force. And one time a request came in from the Naval Academy. I happen to be a graduate of the Naval Academy. A request came in from the Naval Academy with someone who have combat experience to come back and inspire the midshipmen of the Naval Academy. boy, if they ever knew what they were getting when they got me, you know. But anyway, I went back, and there was a parade, and there were some newspaper articles and all that sort of stuff, and a lot of notoriety attached to some awards I got. And all of a sudden, a lot of requests started coming into the Naval Academy to have this super-duper Navy hero go speak to the Kiwanis Club, the Rotary Club, this group, that group, or whatever. So I got on sort of on a speaker tour there. And what would happen, and I'll describe the first one and then tell you what changed. On the first one, I got a call from this Rotary group in Baltimore, Maryland. And they said, we'd really like you to come over and speak and let us know what it's like for a young naval officer to be in combat in Vietnam. And I said, okay. He said, how about you meet us early and we'll treat you to dinner? I said, hey, that sounds good. Yeah, let's do that. So I met these guys, and they said, we were sitting down and waiting for dinner. He said, would you like a drink? Would I like a drink? Oh, yeah, I'll take one. Well, that, unfortunately, that's exactly what they meant. Would you like a drink? Not my type of folks, you know. So anyway, I had dinner with them and et cetera, and I went and made my little spiel, a little slideshow I do, et cetera. And then afterwards, a couple came up and says, hey, would you like to come out with us and have a drink? And, you know, geez, anytime I'm asked to have a drink, the answer is yes, you know. So out I went. And I found out once again that they meant to have a drink. That's the last time. I did this thing probably 30 times in the next year and a half, and that's the last time I ever said yes to even dinner before. I just didn't want anything to do with these guys at all. And so anyway, what happened after that is these guys were all having a drink afterwards, and they're going home. You know, that's a concept very foreign to me. But they're going home because they got a wife and family and stuff like that. I had that too, but the concept of going home is foreign. And so supposing like the first night I made my spiel in Baltimore, and I go out and start drinking, you know, the way I know, understand a drink. The next thing I know, there's the sunlight is shining in my face, and I'm sitting in my car in the driver's seat, and I'm saying, well, I wonder how I got here. Where the hell is this thing? And I look around, and there's a lot of statues. Well, Baltimore doesn't have a lot of statues. It has a lot of little brown stone homes with steps, statues. This must be Washington. Well, I don't have to wonder how I got to Washington. I'm sitting in the driver's seat. And, you know, this type of thing went on for the next year and a half. I'd go out and speak somewhere. I'd go drink my own self and speak in Wilmington, Delaware, wake up in Philadelphia, come to in Philadelphia. Speak in Washington, come to in it was a real bad show. I got a little concerned about this drinking and driving that I was doing, and the classic came this one night when I'm going from the Naval Academy out to where I lived in Bowie, Maryland. It's a distance of about 25 miles or so. Nice road, two lanes this way, two lanes that way, in Maryland State Route 50. And I'm sitting there thinking about all this stuff, and I said, you know, I've really got to watch my drinking and driving. This is starting to get dangerous. I better watch out on this thing. And I'm sitting there, and then I just looked up the road, and the road's nice and straight in front of me and steady. And I'm saying, geez, you know, maybe I'm overreacting to this drinking and driving stuff. Everything is just fine. The road is dead ahead of me here. And as I'm thinking about this thing, I hear this on my driver's window. And I look over there, and there's a face. And the face has got a mouth that's moving. And this is winter in Maryland. It's cold. I got my windows up, you know. And I'm looking, saying, geez, what the heck's going on? Well, I don't have to take this abuse from this guy on my I'll just speed up and leave him in the dust. So I put my foot all the way down the accelerator, and realized that my foot was all the way down in the accelerator. And I looked at my gas gauge, and it said empty. And I looked at the speedometer, and it said zero. And the reason this guy was moving out so fast is that I'm dead stopped right in the high speed. Fortunately, this is a long time ago in Maryland, and there weren't many cars and everything. And the guy, get your goddamn car off the road, et cetera, et cetera, and so I did. But that gives you a little bit of an idea of that I qualify as an alcoholic. I drink too much. There's just no doubt about it. And I really don't know what the hell's happening when I get to that level of drinking. Anyway, that was way back in 65, 66 or something like that. And the reason I point that out is my sobriety date is January 14th of 1985. This is 1965 that I'm driving that way. And I drove that way for the next 20 years. So all of you who are alive this evening, you weren't on the same highways as I was driving in those days. You know, it's just a miracle. I never got in any trouble from my drinking as far as car accident or hurting people or even banging up the cars and stuff like that. So anyway, I qualify as an alcoholic, and that's enough for that. The big part of my story is really what happened. At one point, I got in 1977. Bear in mind, this is 8 years before I get into recovery. And I got to make a statement that I make all the time. I have gotten sober thousands of times. Every morning when I woke up, every time when I'm threatened somewhere, somehow, I get sober. So I've gotten sober. I've gotten into recovery once. To me, I'm just one of those people that believes there's a world of difference. You know, the old classic, if you take a drunken horse thief and you sober him up, you got a sober horse thief. And I did that for years and years. 1977, my boss, who was a three-star admiral in the Navy at that time, and a fairly senior guy at that time myself, he calls me and he says, you know, you're a damn good naval officer. I wonder how good you would have been if you'd been sober some of the time. And I said, I don't think the rest of this conversation is going to be to my liking at all, you know. And he says, I've done some calling around, et cetera, et cetera, and I found out about AA. I didn't know anything about it, but I know about AA now. And, of course, the minute he said that, I know all there is to know about AA. I know my uncles came to it, my dad came to it, and it doesn't do a damn thing except get the heat off you for a period of time. So anyway, he says, this is where you're going tonight. And he told me a meeting to go to. It happened to be in El Cajon at that time. I was here in San Diego. And I went to the meeting in El Cajon, and I heard two things that night. At least, I'm sure I heard more, but only two logged in on my mind. One was 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, hell, I can do that. 90 meetings in 90 days. I'll put my ass in a chair for 90 meetings, and I'll have done 90 meetings in 90 days. And the other thing was, take what you want and leave the rest. Dangerous, dangerous words to a guy like me. I'd sit there and, you know, in the back of the room and looking at, hey, that's a pretty redhead that came in. I think I'll take her. That's such a good-looking brunette over there. I'll leave her alone, you know. And that's just where I was, you know. That's just where I was at that time. So anyway, but the 90 meetings, 90 days, I can do that. I'm a very compliant guy. And the other thing this admiral told me, he says, and I had 18 and a half years in the military, and most of the people in here know, good old San Diego military and stuff like that, you need 20 before you can retire. And I'm at 18 and a half. And the idea of being able to retire at some point is really appealing to me. And he says, if I ever hear of you having another drink, see you having a drink, hear you having a drink, I'll throw your ass out of the Navy that day. And I looked at these three glittering stars up here in his collar, and I said, you know, this guy might be able to do that. And Jesus, that's a year and a half away before I can retire. I guess I just have to stop drinking for a year and a half. You know, and we go, oh, I can do that. That's easy. Well, I went to my 90 meetings, 90 days. I got my first of seven. Congratulations to the 90-day recipient today. That's my first of, that's actually the seventh of my seven 90-day tokens. And I got that token, made a beautiful speech. Everybody said it was just wonderful, marvelous. And about day 94, 95, I was drunk as a skunk. And that type of story goes on for the next almost 8 years of going back, getting caught by somebody other than the Admiral. Fortunately, I got transferred away from him for a while. And going back, 90 meetings, 90 days, 90-day token. Let me tell you how great and wonderful you people are to have helped me out and blah, 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 blah. I never made it to 100 days. Never made it to 100 days. The concept that I had done what I'm supposed to do was all I needed to do. The heat was off, and so was Paul. And so I went through that for a long period. I like to call that trying to get into recovery through a process that I call osmosis. If I sit in enough chairs, something marvelous is going to happen somehow, and I'm going to get into this recovery stuff through a process called osmosis. Sit in chair. And every time after, I'd go out and drink for 2, 3, 4 months, whatever it was, and then someone would say, I thought you weren't supposed to be drinking. Uh-oh, I better get back. Sometimes that something was my wife, too, you know. I continued to come back, continued to get 90-day tokens, continued to make my speech, and continued to go back out and drink before I got to 100 days. To me, and this is just me, of course, but to me, there is a world of difference between sobriety in what I understand, meaning lack of drinking, no booze in my body, between sobriety and recovery. Just a world of difference there. This in-and-out process, and incidentally, during that 8-year time frame, I had one time frame of a little over three years where I didn't drink at all. No program. I stopped going to AA. None of this. This 90 meetings, 90 days isn't working, you know. And so just willpower. Hey, I'm a big, strong, educated guy. You know, big, high IQ, Naval Academy graduate, captain of the Navy, and all that sort of stuff. I don't need this phony stuff of this AA crap. Doesn't work. So I'm just going to make up my mind. I'm not going to drink. And I did for over 3 years. Now, what happened at the end of those 3 years is I used to play racquetball. I thought I could get into recovery through a process called racquetball. I was pretty regularly playing 1 hour a day, and I figured, incidentally, they missed that when they read chapter 3 here. It says, you know, taking a trip, not taking a trip. So that doesn't say increasing your racquetball from 1 to 2 hours. But I tried that. And you know, one of my major character defects that I work on every day of my life is my pride and ego. And now I'm not drinking, and it's all because I've made up my mind that I'm not going to drink. Just make up your mind that you're not going to drink, and there's nothing to it. You know, that was my spiel for over 3 years. And anyway, this one evening, I'm on a ship up in Long Beach at the time, and I'm playing racquetball in the evening and coming back to the ship. And I stop by this Safeway store, and very health conscious and all that sort of stuff, you know, and I got an apple and an orange, or maybe the next night it was an apple and a banana, or a banana and an orange, a couple pieces of fruit. And anyway, this one night, and I've been doing this for months, probably 4 or 5 months or so. And this one night, I've got my apple and my banana, and I'm walking by this container place, you know, and all of a sudden this quart of Budweiser attacked. And there I am. And when I get up to check out, when I get up to check out, there's the same kid there that's been checking me out for a long time. And he looks at me and he says, there's no one behind me. He says, oh, an apple and an orange tonight, huh? And I said, yeah. And he looks up and here's this quart of Budweiser just sitting by itself over there. And he says, whose is this? Is this yours? And, you know, the insult of this little kid asking this war hero old guy if that quart of Budweiser is his or not. Well, yes, of course it's mine. And he's, okay, I've just never seen you have a beer before, you know. And, of course, that pissed me off even more, huh? So, of course, I get out in the car, and I got to tell you this, and make sure you understand what I'm about to say. I haven't had a drink now in over 3 years of any type. Okay, I know AA doesn't work, everything else, the screaming and yelling of the wife doesn't work, all that sort of stuff. And I remember getting out there and opening up that quart of Budweiser and taking a slug of that quart of Budweiser. And I've got to tell you that for me, at that point, nothing in the world has ever felt better or tasted better than that slug of Budweiser. And all I could think about was, why have I been denying myself this wonderful feeling for all this time? And, you know, then the next thing comes into mind of I'm going to control my drinking. I know I'm enjoying it. Now I'm going to control it. I'm going to have maybe a couple of beers a night while I'm up here in Long Beach. My family was still down in San Diego. I have a couple of beers every night after my racquetball because that will balance out pretty well. And then on the way down on Friday night to San Diego, I'll maybe buy a six-pack and maybe a pint of bourbon because that was my drink, the Boilermaker, bourbon and beer. That was my plan for the next three nights, a couple beers, and then Friday night, six-pack and some bourbon. Well, unfortunately, that six-pack and bourbon found its way into my life the next day. Just completely unable to control any amount of it. And, of course, I get on and on in that situation. Finally, it's sort of a funny situation. I get stationed or ordered into a staff here in San Diego again, and lo and behold, who's the admiral in charge of the staff? The same guy who had threatened to throw my ass out if you ever found me having a drink. Now, I thought I could hide it from him, but because I'll just drink vodka. Okay? Just drink vodka. And I found that a pint of vodka in the morning, sometimes people can tell. I was living in El Cajon at the time, and I got to tell you, I don't know what the story is now, but and this was shore duty, so I was going in on Monday through Friday, and that was it. But that's 5 days. And there's four liquor stores that opened in El Cajon at 6 o'clock. My biggest dilemma at that particular time was which one do I go to on Friday, and that's because that's going to be a double up on something I've already been on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, huh? And, you know, I did everything to hide my drinking from the guy who's selling the booze to me, the guy who's opened up the liquor store. As if he's, all he wants me to do is buy booze. Not that, but I'd go in there, you know, and I'd get a loaf of bread and maybe a quarter milk and tell the guy that we were out of milk. I'm going to go home and, you know, turn in this milk and bread to my family, et cetera. And this is for a party tonight or something. And, of course, I'd walk out of the store, look around for the nearest dumpster and throw the milk in and throw the bread in and head on into my job with a pint of vodka. And then I found out that, you know, someone said to me, you smell like a gin mill when you get here in the morning. And I said, oh, man, how the hell does he know? And all of a sudden I realized that my khaki uniform was soaked through. There were beads up and down my arms. And you know what they were? They weren't. There wasn't sweat. It was vodka. You know, it just pours through and some of that. So, anyway, things were obviously not going well at this point, and I'm getting more and more in trouble, et cetera. Nothing legally, nothing, you know, I never had any pressure from that side at all. And my wife is drinking probably as heavy as I am right now, so that's not causing any problem. Anyway. Actually, it was causing one hell of a big problem, but, you know, you get two drunks in the same family, and, you know, neither one of us would point a finger at each other. You know, you're drinking too much. No, you're drinking. It was just silence. The elephant was in the living room, huh? Just silence. Anyway, I continued to do this until about 2 or 3 months in the last part of 84. And, things are just not going well. In fact, what's happening at this point is I've gotten to the point where suicide is starting to sound like a real, real good thought. And those of you, and you know, sometimes when I tell this story, I'm not in San Diego area and people don't know what I'm talking about. But here you will. The route 67 that goes up towards Ramona, when you get up just east of Poway, there's that road, Poway Road, that goes down like a son of a gun, etc. Well, anyway, at the in the last couple of 3 or 4 months of my drinking, things were not getting any better. In fact, I've got four suicide attempts at that point. And they're not just thoughts or ideations. They're the real McCoy. And I get up to the top of the hill and almost pray for the strength to go down that hill, turn, speed up, turn right, drive off, and kill myself. Fortunately, my concept at that point of religion, I guess it was the fact that if I killed myself through suicide, I would go immediately to hell, and I would be a crispy critter for all eternity. You know, and that just didn't sound very appetizing to me, and somehow I always made it to the bottom of the hill. The fourth time down that hill was January 14th of 1985. That's my sobriety date, but it is not the date that I got up and said, hey, I'm not going to drink today because I want to get in recovery or something good. I didn't want to drink because I was afraid that if I killed myself, somehow it would affect the life insurance policy. And I wanted to do something right in my life, and that was at least have a life insurance policy. And I wasn't sure what would happen if they could determine the fact that I was drunk as a skunk when I killed myself. So I didn't drink all that day on the 14th. I got down to the bottom of the hill again. And the other day, Wendy and I were driving up Route 67 or up Poway Road, and I said, boy, this is real. I think it's the first time I've ever gone up the hill. You know, all of us were down the hill. Anyway, we got down there, and I got down there, and, you know, I'm beside myself. I just don't know what the hell to do. And I looked at my clock, and it's a Sunday afternoon. It's about 4:35, something like that. And I've got two choices. I can either go home. No, that's not a good choice at all. Or I can go to the Old Town Speakers meeting. See, I've been going to a lot of AA during these 8 years. Huh? I've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings and the Old Town Speakers. So I went to the Old Town Speakers meeting. And some of you may or may not remember, but back in those days, a little while ago, 25 years ago, there were two folks who were very active in AA here. One was named Jonathan and his wife Jennifer. And Jonathan had been sort of trying to help me for the last 8 years. You know, you don't have da, da, da. So anyway, I walk into the Old Town. This was when it was up in the labor union hall up there. Some of you may remember that. Full of smoke. I haven't had a cigarette in 52 years. Full of smoke, you know. Jesus. And anyway, I was walking in the back. All of a sudden, look up, and there's Jennifer and Jonathan heading towards me. And Jennifer starts crying. And Jonathan walks up to me and puts his arm around me, and he says, did you drive your hill today? And I said, yeah. He says, Paul, you don't have to do that. Let us take care of you, will you? Please, please. And bear in mind, I've heard this from Jonathan for 8 years. And so he says, come on up and sit with us. That's a non-smoking site. Any of you that remember this, in that big union hall, et cetera, up in the front and the left-hand side, there were two little rows. And those were the non-smokers. You know, can't even see each other, but we're non-smokers. You know, so I went up there with them, and all I can tell you is, and of course everybody in that little group knew me. You know, hell, I collected so many tokens at the Old Town Speakers meeting. You know, and they just, you know, said hello to me and welcome back, Paul, et cetera, et cetera. All I can tell you, and this is where I think the grace of a loving higher power comes in, is that when I walked into that room, everything in my life was exactly the same. It was a pile of crap. You know, everything was the same as it had been for years. When I walked out of that room that day, everything was different. And I associate that strictly as the love of the people in these rooms for an alcoholic. You know, it just, when I walked out of there, I said, I can't tell you what it is, but something is different. Something is different. I went back to my regular meetings afterwards, and et cetera. And on day six, which was Friday night, I'm at the meeting over in Navajo at the Catholic Church over there. And there's a guy there who I've been looking at for about the last 5 years. And I've been saying, you know, I keep hearing this word, you got to get a sponsor. You got to work the steps and stuff. But I don't want any part of that. Why would a Navy captain want any of you people to sponsor me, huh? You know, after all, don't you understand who I am? Look at all this stuff up here. And I've been looking at this guy saying, I bet you he'd be a good sponsor. But, of course, I'm not going to ask him because of the fear of rejection and all that sort of stuff. So all of a sudden, on this particular night, this guy walks up to me after the meeting and says, thumps me in the chest, and he says, I don't know if you're sick and tired of this crap, but I'm sick and tired of watching you. I'm going to be your sponsor. You're going to work the steps. You're going to get in recovery. And as I said, that's almost 25 years ago now. Still my sponsor. We still work very closely together, and I think we love each other. And so that, but that all of a sudden turned, you know, and we work steps. I've been around for 8 years now. Oh, these things here? Is that what you're talking about, you know? And anyway, I like to say, and I don't know how true this really, you know, every once in a while we embellish a little bit on our stories. Don't laugh, Terry. And anyway, I don't know how true this was, but I often like to make the comment that Bob ran roughshod over me. You know, you're going to do, and in fact, it was real funny. This is Friday night. This is day six. And he looks at me and he says, I'm going to come by and pick you up on Monday. That will be day nine, huh? I come by and pick up Monday, and you're going to do your fifth step. Well, I've been around this program for a long time, and I know damn well you don't do your fifth step on your ninth day of recovery, you know? And you, hey, Bob, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he says, wait a minute. He says, step one is a statement of the problem, right? That you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable. How much more proof do you need that you're powerless over alcohol and you've tried to stop it for the last 20, 25 years and can't, and your life being unmanageable? Didn't you just say Sunday you tried to kill yourself for the fourth time? Yeah. Well, that will qualify as being unmanageable, Paul. Okay, so that's step one. It's the statement of the problem. The statement of the solution, step two, is nothing you've been trying at all. You know, nothing that you've tried is a satisfaction. It says in our step two that the only solution to your problem is dependence upon a power greater than yourself. And the only power you got that's greater than yourself, you don't have a power greater than yourself, you are that higher power. So he says that's step two. Step three, the fact that you're back at this meeting tonight tells me that you'd rather have the solution than the problem. So he says, you got the weekend. Do your fourth step. I'll come by and pick you up and get your fifth step done on Monday. And we did it pretty fast. On that particular time, I came out with a bless me sponsor for I have sinned. You know, that was my fifth step at that point. Later on, we went back to the real program and the, you know, column one, column two, column all that sort of stuff, et cetera. But that got me started. And I think that's why he did it that way. Boy, if I give this guy one day off, he's going to be gone again. And I tell the guys I sponsor, I've sponsored a lot of people, both out in Hawaii and then here in San Diego and now down in Albuquerque. And I tell them the same thing. You know, I only know one way to sponsor. If you want me to sponsor you, I'll sponsor you. But I only know one way to sponsor. And it's just the way my sponsor sponsored me. I was at a meeting one time, this gal was getting her fourth year cake, and she says, my sponsor tells me that I should start working my first step. Wait a minute. She's got 4 years, and she hasn't worked her first step? You know, anyway, that's not my story, obviously, with Bob and stuff like that, and nor is it my story with any of the guys I sponsor. I tell him, I said, I know a path. We're at the bottom of the hill, and we want to get to the top of the hill, right? He said, yeah. I said, I know how to get from the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill. I've been shown that this path gets up there. And after we start, he says, yeah, this is a pretty steep path. And I said, yeah, but it's the path I know gets to the top of the hill. Well, I'm looking over there, and I see a whole bunch of people, and they're not walking on anywhere near such a steep path. How about that over there? I said, I don't know. I've never been on that path. It may go to the top of the hill. It may not go to the top of the hill. I don't know. But I know this path goes to the top of the hill. So if you want me to sponsor you, you want me to work together, fine, let's go and do it. Okay. And that's just the way it's been. I've been doing it, and it's been working very well. I got one guy down there right now. And this is the classic story, huh, the alcoholic. He came up to me and asked me, please, to sponsor him. And I said, sure, we'll give that a shot, you know. And we went to a couple of meetings together, had some coffee, talked a little bit and stuff like that. And he says, oh, man, he says, I sure am lucky I got a hold of him getting a sponsor and working the steps because, you know, I've been in and out for a long time. I said, I understand the in and out for a long time. 8 years is my situation. He goes, I don't know. Anyway, he says, but I do need a job. And I said, I understand that, certainly. So about a week later, he says, hey, I got a job. I'm working in a used car lot. And I said, hey, that's good. That's a job. You know, you're getting some finances and stop borrowing from your wife and blah, 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 blah. Next thing he calls me a couple days later and he says, I sold my first car. I said, that's wonderful. That's just great. Now, how are you doing on your reading on chapter 3? I'm getting to that, but I sold my, did you hear me? I said I sold my first car. I said, yeah, that's just wonderful. No kidding. A couple days later, he called me. He says, I just sold two cars today. I said, that's great, fantastic. How are you doing on your chapter 3? And the bottom line is that's the last phone call I've ever gotten from him. You know, the old case of, and we say that a lot of times, don't we? Anything I put ahead of my sobriety or my recovery is going to take away my recovery. And so he needed some money. He got some money. I don't know where he is. I lost track of him about 3 weeks ago. But I don't know where that came from, but that's okay. The bottom line of that is, what's it like now? You know, what happened was, a couple other things here. If I got a few minutes. One of the things that... that really helped me a lot. I don't know if this will help you or not or whatever, but it helped me a lot. Is I'm an ex-Catholic, okay? And I've really worked a lot around the God concept. I know what God was as far as how it was taught to me by my mother, by Sister Mona, by Brother Pius, and Father Peters. I know exactly what God is according to them. And that's what they told me it was, okay? I don't know what it was, day, week or two or something, and Bob says, when you get up in the morning, I want you to pray. Oh, Jesus. No sweat, no strain. I could say the rosary fast than anybody else in the world. I could sing the high mass of the angels in Latin, and I can do that today even. I won't hurt your ears with that one. But, I had a very dogmatic Catholic upbringing. Very. I went to Mass Communion members every day of my life until I was 18 when I went to the Naval Academy. That's pretty. So anyway, he says, I want you to pray. I said, sure, what do you want? I can do the rosary. He says, have you been doing a lot of that type praying? And this is about, 2 weeks into my recovery. He says, you've been doing a lot of that praying? I said, yeah. He says, how's it working? obviously it hasn't worked at all, you know. He says, well, but you told me you wanted me to pray. Yeah, I want you to get up in the morning and I want you to ask for help. He says, you're a Navy guy, four-letter words, help. I said, help, okay, like, God help me? He says, what's your relationship with God right now? I said, well, he hates my ass, and I don't really have much use, and I don't have much use for him. He says, is this something you learn in the Bronx? You know, someone that hates you, you ask them to help you, and they get all the help you want? I said, no. He says, well, it doesn't work here either. I said, but you asked me to pray in the morning. Get up and pray, ask for help. He says, that's right. Four-letter word, Navy guy, H-E-L-P. He looked at him and said, just help? He said, yeah, just help. Now, I'm going to trick Bob, and as most of you know, he came in the program, right after the Ice Age. And and I looked at him and said, and just who am I asking help from? And he looked at me and he says, who cares? The most valuable comment I've ever heard in my life. You're asking for help, Paul, which means you're trying to do something today that you cannot do by yourself. With your ego and pride, you would never ask for help if you thought you could do it. So I'm telling you to get up and ask for help. And where you get the help from is none of your business, none of my business. Who cares? And I've had a lot of people come up to me after a period of time and say, that story about who cares, it just took the weight off my shoulders of who is this God character that people are talking about, or power greater than myself, or higher power. And anyway, the bottom line is I've worked on that for a number of years, and I was 10.5 years sober before I finally arrived at the words, Great Spirit. And that's my higher power. I believe it's spiritual. I can't give you a handful of God, right? My higher power, or Great Spirit. It's a spiritual thing, and it's great. Now, this is just Paul in this closing comment here. To me, my Great Spirit is so great, I can't believe that it would allow a devil or hell to exist. So I live a very trouble-free life as opposed to my early Catholic upbringing where everything was, oh, man, I'm going to hell today for that for sure. that is just a case of I believe in my higher power. I get up every morning and do my third step. Third step prayer, third step, and a couple of things. I turn my life and will over to the care of my higher power. And the most important word in the steps to me is care. I don't turn, you know, I don't get up in the morning and say, okay, God, cook breakfast. Okay, dog, or God, take my dog out for a walk. Okay, God, I need to take a pee, you know, or some of that. No, I've got to do all that. But when I've gotten up in the morning and I use my little AA medallion as my hinter, huh? I put my medallion on and I turn my life and will over the care of my higher power. I do my third step prayer. I connect to my higher power. And if necessary, I do it all day long, you know, on and on and on. And I feel, this belief I have, is that as long as I'm in the care of my higher power, as I understand my great spirit, I got nothing to worry about. I'm the guy who sat there when the doctor told him he had cancer and said, so? You know, well, aren't you supposed to react to that? And no, this is way above our pay grade. You know, this is way above our pay grade. Let's not worry about this, you know. And I'll be honest with you, that's how I lead my life. I'm in my higher power, my great spirit's care all day long. And every once in a while, I'll sort of step out of it, and something in here, this little meter will go in the red. You know, say, hey, sport fan, what's going on here? And I'll remember, oh, yeah, I gotta. So I'm real happy to be here. I love my recovery. I love my fellow AAs because it was your love that turned me around on January 14th of 1985 when I went to the Old Town Speakers, a loser, and walked out of there knowing that I was going to be okay because you guys love me. Thanks.